It was a football tournament like no other. England were tremendously successful on the pitch, reaching their first final since 1966, and only losing thanks to penalties. The players also took the decision to take the knee before each game, displaying their opposition to racism in football and society. But sadly, it wasn't all good news. In one of the pre-tournament games, the players were booed for taking the knee, and the three that missed penalties in the final also experienced terrible online abuse and racism. It sadly underlined why they were speaking out against racism in the first place. But manager Gareth Southgate also won wide plaudits for his response. In a widely shared and beautifully written article titled Dear England, he not only backed his players, but explained what patriotism meant to him. Politicians have been struggling with these issues of patriotism, identity, and anti-racism for many years, but now it seemed it was suddenly taking shape on the pitch. And today we talk through all these issues with two impeccably qualified guests.
Germany have joined England in taking the knee. In exchange, Harry Kane has replicated Manuel Neuer's stance of wearing a rainbow captain's armband. Schmeichel saves! Kane is there to follow in! Wembley is alive and thundering with noise!
Those scenes of English fans booing our boys as they took the knee was a disgrace.
That's it, they've done it. Gareth Southgate can add beating Germany in a knockout game at a major tournament to his incredible list of achievements.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper. Our guests today are Shaista Aziz, an anti-racist activist and regular on the show. Shaista is also a member of the FA's Refugee and Asylum Seekers Football Network. We're also joined by former Labour MP John Denham, who is now a professor at Southampton University and director of the Centre for English Identity and Politics. We'll be picking their brains on whether the English football team have finally achieved what politicians have never seemed able to do, a progressive definition of what it means to be English. We'll also ask how this might impact our politics now that the union between the four nations is under strain as a result of Brexit. You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then, but that's why we need to keep going because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe Is Possible your home too.
So Shaista, let's start with you. Well, you're already prominent, of course, but you shot to prominence at the start of the tournament, even more so than normal, simply with a tweet that went viral. It was you and two friends. You were all wearing the hijab, watching the game. You used the hashtag, the three hijabis, and it really took off online. Could you tell us about that? Why do you think it really caught a public mood in the way that it did?
Yeah, so we were watching the England-Ukraine game, which as an England fan, I'm pretty sure that's the most stress-free England match I've ever watched in my life because obviously we thrashed Ukraine with 4 goals. So I took a photograph of us watching the game and I put out a tweet and the tweet was focusing on the inclusivity of the England team, the anti-racist values that the team holds dear and the pro-LGBTQI rights, all of that. And basically my thread was about three friends watching football, as you said, the hashtag was the three hijabis cheer on the three lions. So the riff of that, I think, really worked for people. But I think the reason why it resonated was because I was just telling a story of friendship, of three women out watching football, you know, after the lockdown. We haven't seen each other since the pandemic started. So there's an element of that as well. Also, just talking about, you know, what does it mean to be an England fan who is marginalised and doesn't always feel safe going to football matches, and how this team is anti-racist, loudly and proudly and unapologetically so, and what that means, and the fact that, you know, for many people who have not really felt that football belongs to them, this is the first time where they feel they can get behind the team. So it went viral. The reaction was very, very interesting. There was a lot of emotional outpouring to this story as well, which I found really interesting. Lots of people contacted us, and then it kind of just took a life of its own. I was then contacted by The Guardian a couple of hours after I put the tweet out on a Sunday after the match, and they asked me to write a piece, which I did, and that also got a very strong reaction. And then, you know, the rest is history, as they say, right?
Yeah, and before we bring John in, I suppose my follow-up question is, you've obviously been an England fan for a long time, but it can't have always been easy as a Muslim woman watching the England team and feeling that it included you, right?
So I think being an England fan is hard work for all England fans, to be fair. So much turmoil and being let down and us not playing as well as we should do and as we're predicted to. And, you know, we always sort of fall into that false sense of security that this time around we're going to do it. And it's a painful journey, isn't it? And I've spent too long hiding behind the sofa when the penalty shootout starts, like I know many fans have across the country as well. So I think it's important for us to really note that it's always been painful to be an England fan. However, as a minoritised, racialised woman, yeah, it's not been fun, shall we say. I love football. I've always loved it. But I knew from very early on that I wasn't really supposed to be at football matches. So I grew up opposite the old Oxford City football ground. So literally the ground was directly opposite our house, and the floodlights would shine into my parents' bedroom. And I used to be up against the window watching football and being mesmerised by it. But I never saw anyone who looked like me watching a game. But I was determined to go and enjoy football. So I'd go and watch Oxford United play. I went a couple of times. And then when I moved to London for university, I ended up not that far away from Tottenham Hotspur's ground, so I used to go there and watch football quite regularly, and it was terrifying. Often it was really frightening. There was a lot of misogyny and racism, not just at that ground, but other grounds I went to as well. And the chanting was horrific, and I didn't feel welcome. But like I said, I'm very stubborn. I refuse to let anyone stop me from doing the things I want to do with my life. And I wrote about that in the Guardian piece as well. And I wrote about the fact that minoritized people know that we're a small tiptoe away from being subjected to bigotry. And that was very much the case when I go to watch these matches. But I'm really glad I did, because football culture is starting to change. I'm not saying it's all changed, but it's definitely changing. And more clubs are going out their way, as they should, to ensure there is inclusivity. But I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it was a walk in the park, because it certainly wasn't. But, you know, I love football, so I wanted to make sure, you know, that I was included in, you know, in terms of watching the matches, and so I went.
And John, welcome to the show. Let's bring you in at this stage. I suppose there are two sides to this issue that we're discussing today. I mean, one is the football history, like the history of specifically racism on the terraces. But there's also a broader question about Englishness and how ethnically and socially inclusive, like the concept of Englishness can be. You've been banging the drum for a long time now, saying that the left and progressives need to have a positive conception of Englishness that's racially inclusive and so on. Do you feel that in the sporting sphere, the England football team is starting to sort of achieve what politicians have been unable to do?
I must admit, and thank you for asking me on, I must admit I have quite mixed feelings on this question, because on the one hand, it is great to have England represented by such an attractive and impressive group and diverse group of players as the current team and their manager, because that helps enormously to portray Englishness as Englishness should be. I have a frustration, though, that it's the only time we ever see Englishness. One of the reasons why people were so struck by the England team, as let's remember they were back in 2018, is the rest of the time you barely see Englishness represented anywhere. And if you do, it's likely to be represented in quite a pejorative way. I mean, I just remember not so long ago, The Guardian had a story about racism, which they illustrated with a cartoon of a skinhead wearing a St. George Cross T-shirt. Now, The Guardian, probably fair to say, is a newspaper that would normally be quite quick to call out stereotyping. But they were perfectly happy to stereotype anybody who was English as a racist skinhead. So I have this frustration because, you see, what's been going on is that Englishness has been becoming more diverse and more inclusive, but below the radar. It's an unfinished job. So if you look back at surveys of 2018, you find that about a third of ethnic minorities in England not only identify as strongly English, but are also proud of being English. Now, actually, that's much bigger. Very often on the left, you'll be told all Englishness is closed to people from ethnic minorities. They might allow for Shaista or one or two untypical people. But actually, Englishness is much more extensive amongst ethnic minorities than you think, but nowhere near as it is amongst the white majority population. The good news is that another third of ethnic minorities feel that they could be English, even if they don't personally identify in that direction. So, you know, it's work in progress. We're getting there. As Shaista said, we're nowhere near a fully inclusive Englishness yet. The football team shows us what it could be. The question for the left now is, are we going to be spectators of Englishness, commentators on Englishness until the next football tournament, or are we going to become players? Are we actually going to be part of giving history a shove and building this inclusive Englishness, which when we see it is so attractive?
Yeah, Shaista, what do you think? Can I bring you in to respond on this?
I think Englishness is complicated. It's not a straightforward thing, is it? So, you know, there's a lot to unpack there, but I don't feel any negative connotations towards Englishness, and I never have. I will be upfront and honest and say that, you know, the flag waving, and when I was growing up, when the National Front were very prominent and all of that, sadly, they had, you know, hijacked the flag and they had used it for you know, their version of politics, which is basically hatred. And all of that is entwined into the vision and the imagery around Englishness. But I also think that's been played on for far too long. And I think that, you know, there should be nuance around being English. So you can be proud of being English. Why shouldn't you be? But if you don't want to wrap yourself up in a flag, I don't really wrap myself in any flags, if I'm honest with you. My family is from Pakistan. I'm born and raised in this country. I feel part of this country, even when I'm sometimes told I shouldn't, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not into flag waving. However, if you want to wave a flag, I have no problem with that. But at the same time, I think that we have to go beyond flag waving and we've got to drill a bit deeper. And as John says, we've got to work out what each of our role is in creating the England that we believe in. So I myself come from, you know, a city which is very elite and very white, Oxford. I was born and raised there, but Oxford is one of the most multiracial cities in this country. It's in the Thames Valley region outside of London. It's got the highest percentage of people from what they call FAME backgrounds. And I think this is England. You know, I think England is a really multicultural place and it always has been. And, you know, as a Muslim woman who has chosen to wear a headscarf, I also know that the work that I've been doing around campaigning to end racism in football and society, along with the two other women who wear the hijab, I would not be able to do that in France because I choose to wear a headscarf. Women who wear headscarves in France are not allowed to be part of public life. You know, the hijab is a very contentious issue over in France, as it is in Switzerland, as it is in other parts of Europe, horrifically. I can only do this because of my British identity, so I'm very aware of this as well. But yeah, I do think we need to drill down a bit deeper as well. And also, I'm really interested in the England cricket team as well. We've got a really diverse England cricket team. You've got Moeen Ali, Adil Rashid, Saqib Mahmood, Ben Stokes, born in New Zealand, all the rest of it. Why do we not have the same kind of critique around cricket, for example, that we do of football? I think a lot of things are changing in this country, and I think they're changing in a positive way, but that doesn't mean that we don't need to deal with the issues at hand, which are structural racism and identity, and what does it mean to be English in this country in 2021 and beyond.
If I could pick up a quick point, it is actually a matter of fact that with the one exception of the English Defence League, the far right in Britain has always been British, from the British Union of Fascists always all the way through to British First. And if you look at photographs of National Front demonstrations or British movement demonstrations, you would see 20 Union Jacks for every St. George's flag. Now, it's interesting because there are plenty of people on the left who will describe themselves as British, but sort of fence off that far right Britishness as not about their Britishness because they think they have a Britishness that is inclusive. And that tells us something, which was that when British multiculturalism was developed, and it only happened in England, it was the idea of an equal British citizenship that was the focus of it. English identity has never had the same treatment. So I always say about Englishness, the surprise is not how inclusive it's become, but that it has become so inclusive when neither the state nor political parties nor social activists have been involved in changing it. But we could, if we engaged more, make far more impact. And if as a cricket lover, I could pick up the Chester point, I'll tell you one difference in my view as a cricket fan and as a life member of a county cricket club. By and large, in football, a very talented young black player has got pretty much the same chance as breaking through to the Premier League as a very talented young white player. 30 to 40% of club cricketers in England are of South Asian heritage. Nothing like that number of South Asians in the squads of county cricket clubs. County cricket clubs will hire brilliantly talented players from Pakistan, from India, from Sri Lanka, but they're not spotting the talent on their own doorstep. So my own view is that English cricket won't become quite the same flag carrier for English identity until the county game sorts out its own talent spotting and recruitment and player development. That is happening, but it's happening far too slowly. And I hope that doesn't divert us too much, but I think the difference between the two sports and how much progress they made is that there's a salutary lesson there for cricket.
Shyster, as we're furnishing this new reputation that the Another Europe podcast has of being able to talk about sport, or at least the politics of sport, I was wondering if you'd like to respond to his remarks about cricket, perhaps with reference to what you think needs to happen next in football, because I know you're very involved in the anti-racist work on the terraces.
Yeah, so I agree with what you're saying, John, about cricket, but also I do think it's really interesting how the cricketing structures in our country have managed to nurture talent, working class talent, you know, from South Asian communities, primarily Pakistani background. You know, we've mentioned the Moeen Ali, Adil Rashid, Saqib Amood, who had the absolute pleasure of watching in Lourdes last month. So football has not done that, has it? So football definitely has helped to nurture, as it should, young working class black talent. But we don't have the number of players that we should have from South Asian backgrounds coming through. And that is the real, you know, indictment of football. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to be concerned about how football is being run. But I think that is really, I find that fascinating, given that cricket overwhelmingly is not a working class sport, as we all know. So I think credit should be given, as you've said, to the England, you know, people running English cricket, that they've got their eyes and ears open and they are developing that talent. But I do think that itself is a really, there's very interesting parallels in terms of how, you know, both these sports are, what is it that cricket is doing that football is not able to do or not willing to do to bring that talent on board. So I think there's some good things for us to think about in relation to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm often struck by the way in which the Scottish left and Scottish leftists are very proud, often very proud and contented in their national identity compared to their equivalents south of the border. And, you know, it's really hard to justify that in rational terms, if you see what I mean, i.e. Scotland was just as much a participant in the British imperial tradition. And I think, I guess, the one rational element of it is that, I guess, the Union, just because of the numerical dominance of England and the fact that the UK government and the English government overlap with one another, it always has this kind of And you see that very clearly with coronavirus and the public health measures being different in England, run by the UK government compared to Scotland and Wales and so on, where there's devolution. Englishness and the union can't really be separated from one another, can they? They're sort of bound up in the same complicated story of never having a very clear federal settlement in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, the union always depended on quite an asymmetric set of views about what the union was. The union always allowed people in England to see the union as essentially the extension of English interests and English institutions like sovereignty of parliament. Whilst in Scotland, it was at the same time quite possible to regard the union as a union of nations in which Scotland's own integrity and identity was respected. And that apparent conflict was workable so long as both, and of course there's a Welsh and Scottish dimension to this, but let's just talk about the English and Scottish dimension. So long as both England and Scotland were engaged with a greater enterprise, those different views didn't matter. Now, for a long time, that enterprise was empire, and there was a clear Anglo-Scottish elite that had a vested interest in keeping the union alive. To an extent, that worked after the Second World War, when you had a unitary British state and the Labour government developing a real sense of the British national economy. But now that sense of shared enterprise and that shared sense of elite interests has fallen away. And so Scotland has begun to reimagine itself as a 21st century nation. England, having never had to really ask that question, now has to ask itself that question. And that's why it's so pressing for the left, because the left can't just go on and say, well, we're British, that answers that question, when Scotland and Wales, the other two parts of Britain, are defining themselves differently. So yes, for a long time, Englishness could exist in a sense as a cultural idea, a cultural identity, one of geography, and though vastly diminished now, but as a racial identity for some. Now England has to answer the question, what are we going to do as a political space? Our higher education policy, our health policy, our social care policy is different to that in Wales and Scotland. What is England going to be, and what are the politics of England going to be that face up to the constitutional realities of where we are today?
Today, our democracies often feel very fragile. In my new book, Authoritarian Contagion, I investigate why that is, what's driving the lurch of societies to this authoritarian politics, and what exactly can we do about it. It's a warning of danger, but also an impetus, hopefully, to act. You can order a copy now. Just go to the Bristol University Press website and search for Authoritarian Contagion. This time we'll start with you. John, you've recently written a Labourist article. I think you touched upon this just a moment ago, actually, but let's develop it a bit more, where you called for the construction of something called political Englishness. Could you tell us about that?
Well, when I've talked about political Englishness, I've been trying to understand what it is that's associated with a sense of English identity that has led to people who say, I'm more English than British, voting in different ways to people who say, I'm more British than English. If you go back 20 years, it didn't make any difference, really. In 2001, in the general election, people who said they were more English than British were a bit more likely to vote for the Conservatives, but Labour had a majority amongst all those groups. 20 years later, somebody who says they are more English than British, 70% of them voted for Boris Johnson in 2019. But Tories got far more from the equally English and British in 2019. Labour only did well and actually slightly beat the Tories amongst the more British than English. So I've been asking myself the question, what is it about the politics of Englishness that can explain that? And when you go academically through the data, what you find is one thing in particular, that the people who say they're English have a particular sense of England as a nation which has its own interests. They want a national democracy within England, and they also have a sense of sovereignty vested in England. And the truth is that although Boris Johnson doesn't appeal to England per se, his sort of Anglo-centric British nationalism, his talk about sovereignty, the way they approached Brexit, enabled them to make huge gains amongst those voters at a time when the left wasn't engaging or even recognising those sentiments at all. So my sense is that although we can't win the votes of all of those people, the left actually needs to talk far more about England, to England, including people who are English, as a civic and democratic case for actually governing England better. And my frustration, which I put in the Labour List article, was that Labour calls Wales, Wales, Scotland, Scotland, but it calls England, Britain. It will never talk about England. It will never talk to England. And so we're missing the opportunity to gain a section of those English voters. These are voters who are often on the left of centre economically, even if they're more socially conservative. And Labour can make an economic pitch and a national democratic argument to them if the left wants to.
So, John, I agree with you, but I also think that the left needs to talk less and listen more and stop talking at people as well. I find that problematic about the left, and I am part of the left. And I think with Englishness, I think for me, Englishness really feels like it's not an inclusive concept to me. It doesn't feel like it is, at least. It feels very much like, overwhelmingly, people who want to talk about Englishness, in terms of people who are on my radar at least, they really rejoice in making sure that this is a narrow group of people who are allowed to feel English. In the past, when people have spoken to me about, you know, do you feel British or do you feel English? When I've said, well, I feel British 100%, but I also believe that I'm English, I've been told you're not English. So I've had immediate pushback about that. Less pushback about being British, but definitely more pushback about being English. And I wonder what that's really about.
Well, I think this is about where the first part of the discussion, which is about football and English identity in that context, comes together with the politics of the left, because there has always been that strand of Englishness that says it's a white identity that is vastly reduced and actually halved in the decade either side of the Brexit referendum. So things are moving in the right direction on that. But the left both has to talk to England, but make it clear that the inclusiveness of that Englishness is not negotiable. So this is not a cipher for sort of appealing to white working class voters as white working class voters. This is about talking about the sort of England that we want to make. Now, there will be some people who will reject that, but there are many who are completely open to it. So I think the left here, there's a danger the left waits until Englishness is in a form that it can embrace. But actually, the left needs to be making that Englishness. And if you go back and talk to the pioneers of British multiculturalism in the 1980s, they had the same debates. There were plenty of people on the left in the 1980s who said that Britishness will always be colonialist, will always be imperialist, will always be racist. And those activists then said, well, that's not good enough for us. We want a Britishness that belongs to us all. And I think this is where the left, and I'm not putting the onus here on ethnic minority members of the left as a whole needs to be part of building that inclusive Englishness as it talks to England. And so the two halves of the conversation, the one about football and identity and the one about left strategy and the left Englishness, come together.
John, you're now outside of Parliament working as an academic, so you can talk with complete freedom, I hope. So I was just curious as to whether the logical conclusion of your argument about England was that you're sympathetic to Scottish independence. You mentioned earlier in the discussion that Scottish civic identity, a civic national democratic Scotland, has kind of been forged over the last couple of decades, certainly bound up with the rise of the SNP, but there's lots of other civil society, social movement things going on in the Independent Scotland campaign. Is that the logical conclusion of your position, that you're quite sympathetic?
It's not what I want to see what happens. I mean, my view is that the things that held the union together in the past, notably empire, and then for a briefer period of time, the post-war centralised unitary state, their time has passed. And the only way of sustaining a union in the 21st century is as of a union of nations that, in a sense, know they're coming together because there are things that we can achieve better together. So I think we are in a midpoint at the moment between the old union coming apart and the forging of a new union. And it may be that becomes impossible to do. I hope not, because I think it is very clear that there are things like the zero carbon transition, building a post-Brexit economy, having a fair and prosperous and inclusive United Kingdom that can be better achieved by the different parts of the union working together by consent. But that's where we have to get to. So within that, that means separating out the confusion between the government of England and the government of the union, for example. Whether we can do that journey, I don't know. I think if we do fail to forge a new union for the 21st century, it will be a failure of imagination and political will. I mean, you and your group, I think, would regard where we are with the European Union as a failure of imagination and will to see that something different and better could exist. I guess in relation to the union, I'm in a similar position. I would rather it didn't fall apart, but it certainly can't be saved as it is at the moment or sustained as it is at the moment, because the reason for it existing is no longer the one that used to be there.
Another union is possible.
Yeah, well, that's a slogan.
So, Shyster, I suppose this is more a comment, but I hope you'll have something to say, is that the idea broadly that people are members of a national community can help cohere an equality agenda, because it means that members of those national community can broadly be treated equally. And if some parts of society have wealth that is unimaginable to the great majority of the rest of society, then that's quite a big problem for the nation state, or at least should be. I say that cautiously because obviously all over the world, ethnic nationalism is proving quite helpful to elites that want to protect their privileges. But I was struck, I think it was a news story a few days ago, that Steve Baker had come out with quite an interesting critique of the government's levelling up agenda. He represents a constituency in Buckinghamshire, I think it's High Wycombe, and he pointed out that there's a food crisis in his constituency, even though it's not a prototypically left behind area. Indeed, it's seen as part of the prosperous home counties. And here I think there could be something, you know, this could help, like whether it's Labour or whether it's another progressive movement or whatever. This reality seems to be something that the left needs to be talking about, because, you know, the idea that there are no poor people in the home counties, or that there's only left behind places in the north and there's no poverty in inner London or whatever, this is clearly a preposterous and untenable idea. And insofar as the government suggests that that is what inequality in England in the 21st century looks like, is pretty mad, and it's a weakness of their levelling up agenda.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, I saw the headline saying the food poverty in the home counties, like it was a revelation, you know. But of course there's going to be food poverty in the home counties, as there is in other parts of this country. It's very shameful that this is the case. But yeah, you know, I think one of the most significant aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic is that some people at least, are starting to look up and look around them and see what's happening in the communities that they've lived in, sometimes often segregated communities, economically segregated, racially segregated, and they're starting to piece together some of the realities, you know, around them, and it shocked them. You know, I have friends who work for the DWP and others, and they've told me that they've been inundated with phone calls from people from middle class backgrounds who've been on furloughed, you know, really trying to understand how the benefit systems work, trying to work out, you know, how if they need to lean on that system, on the welfare state, can they do that, etc. It's the first time in their life that they're engaging with this area of policy, and they're quite horrified by the fact that actually, if you are on the breadline, you know, the welfare state pretty much has been on its knees for, you know, a long time, but especially in while the austerity projects have been in full swing, you know, people are, I think, starting to wake up to find out, you know, how people around them are living, and it's coming as quite a shock. So I think that overwhelmingly, I believe that people are decent in this country, as I do believe in many countries. And I think that for too long, there have been political narratives and stories that have been developed by mainstream media that are busy separating people and pitting minorities and communities against each other. And like I said, this COVID-19 pandemic is showing that actually, you know, I'm going to be slightly cautious when I use this term, but we are in this together. But the question is, where do we go from here, really? So I do think there is something around at this particular moment in time, that the left, the progressive left at least, should be working on to bring more of us together to build a genuine inclusive vision for the people of this country, regardless of, you know, what colour they are, what background they are, etc. And I do think it's very possible to do that. And I think thus far there's been not enough visionary ideas coming forward.
Can I just add something to what Shelley's to say? Because she's absolutely right to discuss these problems. And they're very, very deep-seated. I'm involved in a think tank called the Southern Policy Centre. And we published a report just on Friday looking at the social outcomes on central southern England, particularly the coastal strip from Bournemouth over to Portsmouth and Havant. And actually the outcomes here, or in what is technically part of the southeast, are pretty much exactly the same as those in what you would think of as the typical targets of levelling up. Many of these problems have been with us for a very long time. They're not new. And the policy proposals we often get about skills training and so on have been tried before without really hitting the button. Now, where this links to the question of patriotism, if you like, or the nation, is that I think we need to be telling a story that this is a country and a nation that should be run in the interests of the majority of people. The people who, by and large, have been so disciplined, so supportive to each other, so looking after each other during the pandemic. And we can draw a sharp contrast between the people of England and how they have behaved and the people, for example, who've been awarding PPE contracts to their friends, the people who stand by while the hedge funds assets strip what's left of the UK-owned UK economy. So talking about the nation becomes a way of drawing a distinction between the majority of people in whose interest the country should be run and those who are actually only organising things to benefit themselves and a few people like them. So it becomes another political way to frame the arguments that the left needs to meet. And one of the challenges facing the left is often we don't sound as though we're telling a story for the majority rather than a minority, whether it's economic or ethnic or whatever. By telling an inclusive national story, we actually enable the majority to see them, their shared interests against the minority who are acting in an unpatriotic way, that are looking after themselves, not most people.
Yeah, I agree with that fully, John. And I think the left, we have a lot of stories that we need to tell and a lot of stories we need to listen to. But I think one of the things that we've urgently got to stop doing is talking to ourselves. And like I said earlier on, you know, we need to start listening to people. I mean, one of the most, you know, one of the images that's really embedded in my mind is around about Christmas time last year when all the truckers were stuck in like endless traffic, trying to get to Dover. And, you know, the government handed them, you know, cereal bars and ridiculous like things like that to get them through this crisis like days before Christmas. And it was actually the local Sikh communities in the area that organised food and, you know, made sure all those truck drivers had the food. And for me, that's the story of the pandemic. The story of the pandemic is that people and communities have come together every single turn and they've made sure that their neighbours and the people they've never met before, they don't know their names, that they have food, they have shelter, they have what they need, they have, you know, symbolically someone's putting their arms around them and showing them that they care about them, while the state and the government have failed in that. And that was really the overarching image in my brain at that time. And I think that's continuing right now as well, isn't it? And definitely, as a left, we need to get much better at building a narrative that includes all of us and that is a story about all of us, which then takes me back to football. And one of the reasons why I believe this England team has done something extraordinary is because they understood the power of that and they were able to tell our story as a collective. And I think that was one of the most powerful things that's come out of the pandemic so far.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think that's so important.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms, but the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, we ask our guests if Brexit was a revolt of the English, and to a lesser degree the Welsh, what were they revolting against exactly, and what implications does this have for the progressive left? It's a good chat. If you want to listen, just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. You can join at anotheureupe.org/join. It doesn't cost much at all and makes a big difference.